Okay, so last week we covered introduction to chapter 19 of the law. The introduction was primarily definitions, concepts of law, etc. Some, you know, kind of some of the questions that we're going to find answers to as we go through the chapter. And, you know, I'll tell you one of the things that's very interesting, at least to me, about the confession is that, you know, the controversies that exist in the church today, the controversies that believers talk about and that differ on, and I'm not talking about non-believers or cults or, you know, I could, you know, name several churches right now, but or denominations, so to speak. They're not church, they're not Christian, but we're not talking about the difference of those. I'm talking about the difference between, like, dispensationalists and Arminians, between even Presbyterians and Baptists, between Lutherans and Baptists, between all these different variations. And some are significant, but let's be honest, some are not significant. They're really not significant in the scheme of things. They are still Scripture. They are still doctrine. They do still make a difference. But all of those things are covered explicitly in the confession. And this chapter of the law is no different. So there is a lot of discussion in Christendom today about the role of the law and the antinomianism, which is those that don't believe that there's any law that applies anymore. Who does the moral law apply to? Who does it not apply to? Is there a difference between moral law, ceremonial law, and judicial law of the Old Testament? Or is it just law? Did Christ come to wipe out the law? Or when he fulfilled it, did that mean that now there's no more law? You know, how all of those questions that come up today, which seem sometimes to be like, here's this new issue we've got to figure out, are not new issues. They've been around for hundreds of years, and they put them in the confession. So as we go through this chapter, I think you'll see that a lot of the things that we're still talking about today are covered in this chapter specifically. I mean, they actually talk about that particular issue. So it's not like we had to wonder, okay, well, we covered the law, now what about this? I think you're going to find all the answers here, all the answers to your questions that you might have about the law and its applicability and all that. So, anyway, so last week was all introduction. That was kind of an introduction right there, wasn't it? Yeah. But anyway, so now we'll get right to paragraph one. God gave to Adam the law of universal obedience written in his heart, and a particular precept of not eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, by which he bound him and all his posterity to personal, entire, exact, and perpetual obedience, promised life upon the fulfilling, and threatened death upon the breach of it, and eluded him with power and ability to keep it. Power and ability to keep it. All right, so first of all, we're talking about the substance of this paragraph. What is the substance of it? Well, it's basically the beginning. God gave to Adam a law of universal obedience written in his heart, and a particular precept of not eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. So this is first of all a universal law. In other words, the law that God gave to Adam is a law that did not specify the specifics that Adam was to obey. It didn't give the specifics. Does that make sense? It demanded universal obedience or obedience in everything. Now you're saying, well, wait a minute. You're mentioning here the tree of good and evil. Well, yeah, that's because the law was written on his heart and not stated. It's the universal understanding of the creation that they must obey the Creator. Now, I want you to think about that for a second. So, Adam is given a law on his heart. Now, how do we know this? Well, we see it from later passages, which we're going to see a couple in a minute. But I want you to think through this logically, because it is very simple logically. There's one prohibition that he gave him. Don't eat from that tree. The knowledge of good and evil, right? But remember, what else happened? What did he tell Adam? He gave him a job, didn't he? In fact, he gave him a couple of jobs, didn't he? Like, what did he tell him to do? Name the animals, right? What else? Dress and keep the garden. Now, notice that we don't see him telling him, Adam, you have to do what I say. Dress and keep the garden. You see this? He told him what to do, implied, not in Scripture, not even spoken by God. is the understanding that the creation must do what the Creator has told him to do. Does this make sense? Neither positive law nor negative law, it is the law of obedience by position. So think about that for a second. When we talk about this law that's written in man's heart, it is not positive law nor negative law. It is the law of position. You must do this because of your position to God. You must do this. Now, let me just clarify for a second. When we say we must do this, we mean it is your duty to do this. Okay, you understand what I'm saying? We're not saying that we're robots and you cannot disobey. We're not saying that. We all know that that's not us, and we also know that that's not Adam, right? Adam had the ability to not disobey, but he did disobey, didn't he? Obviously. This inherent law of obedience was a reflection on the image of God. So the idea that you are going to obey this higher authority is a reflection of the image of God. It is His righteous, holy, and sovereign image. Now, does God have to obey anybody? No. No, there is nobody above God. There is nothing above God. There is no way that God is under anything in any way. But His position makes it automatic. What's the specific precept that's here now? There was a specific law that God gave to Adam that he not eat of the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. This was negative law, stating what Adam could not do, leaving everything else in liberty for Adam to do. All right, so look, don't eat from this tree. If I'm Adam, I could have said, what about that tree? Don't eat from this tree. What about that tree? Don't eat from this. What about that? Don't eat from this tree. You see where we're going. He was at liberty to do other things because this is the law he was told. Don't do this. Don't do this. What about running? Am I allowed to do that? Can I jump in the water? Or should I not? Is that against no lifeguard? I mean, what, you know. No. This is it. This is it. Don't eat from that tree. That's liberty, isn't it? You think Adam might have tried to see if he could climb on a horse and ride him? He might have. And there's no law that says he couldn't. Right? If he had a dog like Jenny, he might try to ride the dog. We don't know. I'm just saying. He had the law of liberty here. It was negative law. God only said one thing. Don't do this. Indeed, since the fall, man has continually pushed the boundaries of sin and sought to exploit his liberty by violating God's law. So we know that that's true. So there's two verses in reference here. One is Genesis 1:27. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him, male and female created he them. And then Ecclesiastes 7:29. Lo, this only have I found, that God hath made man upright, but they have sought out many inventions. Now, have we not seen this through time? We certainly have. What do we see happen before the flood? Man tries to find ways to sin, is what the Bible told us. Is that he tried to find ways that he could actually sin, and he has sinned in many ways. So this is actually referencing that as well. Man tries to find these men. By the way, this passage in Ecclesiastes is not a passage where he's talking about man is an inventor. And somehow that's wrong. Quite the opposite. Quite the opposite. It's talking about the fact that man in his mind sins and finds ways to sin. And if you know from your own self, if you're honest, you know that that's true for you too. All right, it's obligation. So the paragraph continues, by which he bound him and all his posterity to personal, entire, exact, and perpetual obedience. I never come over to this side, so I should come over here. Maybe you guys feel a little more. I think it's something to do with my right hand, left hand. And Kathy feels pressured probably because I'm always in front of her over there, so I'll come over here and pressure you guys a little bit. At any rate, God bound him and all his posterity, which means Adam, as the representative of all mankind, was commanded, and we have the same responsibility to obey. Who has the responsibility? All his posterity. That's what this passage, this portion of the paragraph is saying. By which he bound him and all his posterity to obedience. Complete, perpetual, exact obedience. He commanded Adam to do it, said, look, this is what you need to do. Now, the Bible tells us that it's all his posterity are under the same rule, which is why when he sinned, it fell on all of us to be born now in sin. To what exactly? Well, obviously you can see what it says. Personal, entire, exact, perpetual obedience. The confession is completely clear and spells out how broad a context all of mankind's responsibility is to obey God. Romans 10:5. For Moses describeth the righteousness which is of the law, that the man which doeth those things shall live by them. Now we're gonna break that down a little bit further as we go here in the next paragraph, but that's the basic concept. Okay. So the paragraph continues, promised life upon the fulfilling and threatened death upon the breach of it, and endued him with the power and ability to keep it. So this is, we're talking about its enforcement here, and notice that it had, of course, it had a promise and then it had a threat, didn't it? And life was for obedience. That was the promise. In other words, the implied promise by God to Adam was that as long as he obeyed his prohibition, he would live. Did the prohibition say that? Did he say, don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil and you'll live? No, it's negative law. If you eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, don't eat from it. If you do, you're going to die. What's the implication? Don't eat from it, you're going to live. See this? Now, there's lots of discussion about what if. If Adam and Eve would not have eaten from the tree, or another offshoot of that is, what if Adam hadn't eaten? Eve did, but Adam didn't. Then what would have happened? How would his life have been sustained? Would he actually have had to eat from the tree of life? Was the tree of life in the garden? Excuse me. Is that how he would have lived and continued to live as long as he eats from that tree? And is that why, indeed, he would have continued to live in that state, but he couldn't because he couldn't eat from that tree because he was barred from the garden? Is that it? Okay, here's the bottom line. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. We can play what-ifs all day long. So what? That isn't what happened. It doesn't matter what would have happened. It mattered what did happen. And what did happen was he ate. Does that make sense? Okay. Death for disobedience. The promise of punishment for disobedience is clearly stated to Adam here. But notice, God also gave Adam all he needed to obey his command. He merely had to abstain from one tree, but could eat from all the rest. Therefore, the law, the implied promise, and the threatening punishment were accompanied by Adam's ability to obey it. If you understand what we're saying here, we're saying is, this is not an impossible situation that God put Adam in. Adam could choose to do what God said. He did not have to eat from that tree. It was not an overwhelming temptation to him. He just followed the temptation and succumbed. He had the ability to not do that, but he did it. This was not a command which was impossible. Obviously, he could have and should have obeyed it. Galatians 3:10-12. I'll look at 10, 11, and 12. For as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse. For it is written, cursed is everyone that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of law to do them. But that no man is justified by the law in the sight of God is evident, for the just shall live by faith. And the law is not of faith, but the man that doeth them shall live in them. Now, what's interesting about that passage, and we're going to break this down as we continue on. What's interesting about that passage is it's actually talking about the fact that we have the ability to follow the law if we don't sin. But we do sin, and we're born in sin, and so it's difficult for us. So what do? We don't have to follow the law to be saved. But we do have salvation through Christ. It's not through the law. This passage just mentions a few things, but we're going to continue to break this down as we go. All right. So the Mosaic codification of the law of God. See, I'm following the outline. I don't know if you see this. So here's a repetition of the moral law, paragraph 2. So now we're going to break it down a little bit more. The same law that was first written in the heart of man continued to be a perfect rule of righteousness after the fall and was delivered by God upon Mount Sinai in 10 commandments and written in 2 tables, the 4 first containing our duty toward God and the other 6 our duty to man. All right, so first, The first is the fact of its reiteration. All right, now, what do we mean by that? All right, what we mean is that the law, which was written on man's heart before the fall, continued to be true after man had sinned. Now you're saying, you mean don't eat of the tree? No, we mean that you must obey God. You must obey God and be righteous. Now you say, well, how would they know what it is? It was written on their hearts. Now, what we're going to see, we're going to look at, and I think, to tell you the truth, I think it's a little enlightening, is all the places that the law of God is clearly stated before the Ten Commandments were ever given. And I don't mean that God told that man. I mean that man knew it was wrong to do sin. Knew it was wrong. So we'll see that. Man's sin did not negate the law of obedience due from man to God, right? So even though Adam sinned, that doesn't mean, okay, well, now we just don't have, we can just do whatever we want to do now. No, you still have a responsibility to follow the law of God. Why? Because you're the creation. He's the creator. That's why. Now, understand, this is what we're saying here in our confession. Our doctrinal statement says this, but there are those today that would argue I'm completely wrong in what I'm saying. That no, we don't. We don't have to follow the law at all. We can do whatever we want to do. We're saved. We're in. That's it. No rules. No holds barred. You can do whatever you want to do. Antinomians. That's what that is. That perfect rule of righteousness given by to the creation by its creator will be in effect for all eternity. That's what we're talking about here. So let me read that passage to you. Romans 2 verses 14 and 15. For when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these, having not the law, are a law unto themselves, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another. What this passage is talking about is, Paul is referencing the Gentiles and saying this, look, the Gentiles keep the law, and they haven't been taught the law. Why? Because it's in their hearts. They obey it because it's in their hearts. And they even find excuses of why it's okay for them not to obey the law, or they, actually that's what it says right there, or they accuse themselves or accuse each other for not following the law. What law? Is it the law of the Ten Commandments? Is it the law of Moses? The law of Israel? The law of the Jews? No. They don't know it. But they still follow it. Why? Because it's the moral law from God. That's why. It exists outside of the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments were not when we got the law. You with me on that? The Ten Commandments were not when we got the law. We got the law when we were created. The Ten Commandments clarified. We'll see it. If pagans, Gentiles, had the law written in their hearts, it's only because it was written in Adam's heart and not erased by the fall. How else did they get it? In other words, if Adam's sin made the law negated, doesn't apply anymore until God gives us the Ten Commandments. That was given to Israel. So how did the Gentiles have it? Now here's a bigger question. If the law wasn't in effect, then how would God be justified with killing everyone on earth except for 8 people in the flood? That was before the Ten Commandments. He wiped out the entire world except for 8 people. Why? Because his law was still in effect. There was still sin. There was still good and evil. You with me? That's a pretty simple argument. We'll see some other passages, though. We're not even going to talk about the flood passages when we go through the passages. All right, proofs that the moral law was in existence between the fall and the Mosaic covenant or the Ten Commandments. So here are some of those things, and I would suggest it might not be bad if you kind of tried to flip and do a little bit of a Bible drill with me. So turn to Genesis chapter 2 if you would like. And then we'll go to Genesis chapter 8, and then we'll go to Exodus 16, and I was wrong. The second passage is the flood. I forgot about that. But at any rate, so we're going to see these. And so here's what we're looking at. We're looking at texts in Scripture. So you know where we're going to be here. We're going to be prior to the Ten Commandments, from creation to prior to the Ten Commandments. We're going to look at passages where the commandments, or these various laws, are reflected. Does that make sense? Where we see people responding to those. So what's the fourth commandment? That's where we're starting here. What's the fourth commandment? Sabbath day, right. It's a Sabbath. We could call it don't profane the Sabbath, do not profane the Sabbath, but it's honor the Sabbath, right? Keep the Sabbath. Let's look at some passages. Genesis 2:3, and God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in it he had rested from all the work which God created and made. So here we see Genesis 2:3, God actually establishing the seventh day as a special day, right? Now let's go to Genesis 8. Genesis 8, verses 8 through 12. And you're going to see here, very interesting, here's Noah doing some tests, and what does he base his tests on? 7 days. 7 days. Also he sent forth a dove from him to see if the waters were abated from off the face of the ground. But the dove found no rest for the sole of her foot, and she returned unto him in the ark, for the waters were on the face of the whole earth. Then he put forth his hand and took her and pulled her into the ark. And he stayed yet another 7 days. And he sent forth a dove out of the ark, and the dove came in unto him at the evening, and lo, in her mouth was an olive leaf plucked off. So Noah knew that the waters were abated from off the earth. And he stayed yet another 7 days, and sent forth a dove, which returned not again unto him any more. Why did Noah use 7 days? It's a week, it's a created order. Look, here's what we do now, right? We know, quote unquote, from the rotation of the earth, orbit of it around the sun, we can break down how many days it takes, we can look at moon cycles, we can actually come up with a plan for the months, all those things you can do with celestial navigation understanding, except for the week. There is nothing that works to the week. Nothing. Except creation. It's the only thing. So why did Noah wait 7 days? 7 days. Why? Because this is the pattern God had already established. Let's go on. Exodus 16. We're going to read verse 15 to 30. So it's a long passage. But here, so let me just introduce it. You'll recognize it as soon as we... It's not like, you know, a surprise passage you've never read before. Okay, this is about manna. This is about manna. So again, this is before the Ten Commandments. Before the command on the Sabbath. What does God tell them to do about manna on the Sabbath? Remember this? Let's read it. Exodus 16, verse 15. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said one to another, it is manna, for they wist not what it was. Which manna means, what is it? I mean, literally. And Moses said unto them, this is the bread which the Lord hath given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord hath commanded. Gather of it every man according to his eating, an omer for every man according to the number of your persons. Take ye the every man for them which are in his tents. And the children of Israel did so, and gathered some more, some less. And when they did meet it with an omer, he that gathered much had nothing over. And he that gathered little had no lack. They gathered every man according to his eating. And Moses said, let no man leave it off till the morning. Notwithstanding, they hearkened not unto Moses, but some of them left it off until the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was wroth with them. So you understand what happened. He said, look, if you're taking enough to eat for the day, an omer for every person, then you're not going to have any left over. Don't keep it overnight. Why? Because God said to only take enough for you. They didn't obey. They left it, and it stank and got worms. Blech. And they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating. When the sun waxed hot, it melted. And it came to pass that on the sixth day they gathered twice as much bread, two omers for one man, and all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. And he said unto them, that is that which the Lord has said, tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that which ye will bake today, and seeth that ye will seeth, and that which remaineth over lay up for you to be kept until the morning. And they laid it up until the morning, as Moses bade, and it did not stink, neither were there any worms therein. And Moses said, eat that today, for today is the Sabbath unto the Lord. Today ye shall not find it in the field. 6 days ye shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, in it there shall be none. And it came to pass that there went out some of the people on the seventh day for to gather, and they found none. And the Lord said unto Moses, how long refuse ye to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord hath given you the Sabbath, therefore he giveth you on the sixth day the bread of 2 days. Abide ye every man in his place, let no man go out of his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. Okay, so look, before the Ten Commandments, clearly, I mean, this is, we don't study that too often, do we? That particular aspect of manna. Before the Ten Commandments were ever given, God gave them the example of what to do for the Sabbath. He already told them, don't go out of your place on the Sabbath. You see this? Stay home. Don't cook. Cook it on Saturday. Now, by the way, you know, there's been all kinds of, it never surprises me, but it disappoints me, how many times there'll be some usually famous Christian preacher who will start getting on the bandwagon of explanations for how God made the miracles. Now, that's always the tack they take, by the way. It's never scientific explanations that show that it's not a miracle. What they do is they say, this is scientific explanations so that we can just see how wonderful it is, how God used things to actually accomplish the his will and things that appeared as miracles. Now you say, well, okay, where are you going with this? All right. Let me give you an example of it, and then we'll bring it back to manna. An example is, I think I mentioned it a week or two ago, and it was about the water in Egypt turning red. You remember this? And the explanation now is that there was a volcano, I believe it was in Italy, that had a certain kind of rock, and that rock, when the volcano went off, which was a huge eruption, they think, happened around this time, maybe, that eruption would have, the ash could have, by the jet stream, go down and actually would have hit Egypt, and it would have mixed with the water, it would have made the water look red. Then, the water was now polluted. So the fish died. And the frogs came out of the water. And then the locusts came to eat the frogs. You see how this goes? Now, you know what that's doing? It's saying it wasn't God. The Bible does not say, this is why your translation matters, by the way. The Bible doesn't, if you have a good one, it doesn't say red as blood. It says, turn to blood. You see the difference? And the Bible actually goes one step further. Why? Because I think God knew that there's going to be idiots like the people we have around today. And he says that it turned the water in the pitchers to blood. How do you explain that? You can't. The Reed Sea, Red Sea. Heard this before? Well, the cross on the Red Sea. No, no. It was actually a reference to the Reed Sea. Of course, all right, so when God then let the waters come back down, how did it drown Pharaoh's army? They couldn't travel through a foot of water? Doesn't make any sense. Of course, you know recently, by the way, they found a whole bunch of chariots in the bottom of the Red Sea. Literally, in the bottom of the Red Sea. You can't explain. How are those there? The first explanation was it was a ship that sunk that had chariots on it. Except they found no remnants of the ship. And then the second was is they found them in a line for a long period. So a ship doesn't break apart like that. Then you stopped hearing about it. Any rate, so think about manna. I've heard this too. Well, this was a certain kind of a plant, and there's some kind of a name for it that comes out at certain times of the year, and it's a seed, and you can gather it. It'll come back the next day. It's very rapidly growing. All right, I've heard this before. Okay. Do you notice? Let me point out a few things that we just read. Number one, it didn't come out on the seventh day. People went out. It says here, not only did it say that God said, don't go do it, it said that people went out on the seventh day and they couldn't find any. Doesn't it? Also notice that it said, you notice something else here that it says? It says that when the sun got hot, it melted. See that? There's no known seeds that do that. What does that mean? It was a miracle. That's what it means. It was God performing a miracle for the nation of Israel. That's what it means. Whenever we say that God had to use something special to make that happen, what we're saying is he's not God. That's the real problem. We're saying he's not God. Let's keep going. All right. Fifth commandment. Honor father and mother. Turn to Genesis 37. Genesis 37, verse 10. Well, this is Joseph talking to his father. Actually, it's his father talking to Joseph. Here's what he said. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. His father rebuked him and said unto him, what is this dream that thou hast dreamed? Shall I and thy mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee, to the earth? Now, this is a reference to Joseph telling them of his dream that they were going to all bow down to him. But you see what the offense is that his father's saying? Are you saying I'm going to bow down to you? Why is he saying that? Because that would not be the son honoring the father. That would be the father honoring the son. Do you see this? Just a reflection. That's all. Sixth commandment, do not murder. Genesis 4. If you could turn there for a second. Verses 3 through 15. Genesis 4. You're going to recognize it. And in the process of time, it came to pass that Cain brought of the fruit of the ground an offering unto the Lord. And Abel, he also brought of the firstlings of his flock, and of the fat thereof. And the Lord had respect unto Abel and to his offering. But unto Cain and to his offering he had not respect. And Cain was very wroth, and his countenance fell. And the Lord said unto Cain, Why art thou wroth? And why is thy countenance fallen? If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him. And Cain talked with Abel his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel his brother, and slew him. And the Lord said unto Cain, Where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said unto him, What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. And now art thou cursed from the earth, which hath opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth. And Cain said unto the Lord, My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from thy face shall I be hid, and I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth, and it shall come to pass that everyone that findeth me shall slay me. And the Lord said unto him, Therefore, whosoever slayeth Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark upon Cain, lest any finding him should kill him. Now, obviously, the big deal here is that Cain killed Abel. And then there was a punishment for that, wasn't there? This is way before the Ten Commandments. But it was still wrong to kill. Seventh commandment, no adultery. Genesis chapter 12, verses 14 through 18. Genesis 12, this is the story of Abraham. And it came to pass when Abram was, It came to pass that when Abram was coming to Egypt, the Egyptians beheld the woman, that she was very fair. Who are we talking about? His wife, Sarah's wife. The princes also of Pharaoh saw her and commended her before Pharaoh. And the woman was taken into Pharaoh's house. And he entreated Abram well for her sake. And he had sheep and oxen, and he had asses and manservants and maidservants and she-asses and camels. And the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarah, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, What is this that thou hast done unto me? Why didst thou not tell me she was thy wife? What's the big deal here? Pharaoh took Sarah into his house to become his wife. That would be adultery. Are we saying that it happened? No. In fact, what we think is that he was preparing her. He was preparing her. But God steps in. God steps in and causes bad things to happen. Why? Because adultery was wrong. Did the Pharaoh do something wrong in his actions? It doesn't appear that he did. Because he didn't know. You see this? Was still wrong. Eighth commandment, do not steal. Genesis 31. Genesis 31, verse 24 through 30. And God came to Laban, the Syrian, in a dream by night, and said unto him, Take heed that thou speak not to Jacob, either good or bad. Then Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mount, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mount of Gilead. And Laban said unto Jacob, What hast thou done, that thou hast stolen away unawares to me, and carried away my daughters as captives taken with the sword? Wherefore didst thou flee away secretly, and steal away from me, and didst not tell me that I might have sent thee away with mirth, and with songs, with tabret, and with harp? And hast not suffered me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Hast thou now done foolishly in so doing? It is in the power of my hand to do you hurt, but the God of your father spoke unto me yesternight, saying, take thou heed that thou speakest not to Jacob either good or bad. And now, though thou wouldst needs be gone, because thou sore longest after thy father's house, yet wherefore hast thou stolen my goods? Now, you see the reference here. We're going to flip over to Genesis 44 in a second. But you see the problem. Laban is upset. Why is Laban upset? Because he's saying, you stole my daughters and you stole my stuff, my goods. This is prior to the Ten Commandments. Stealing was wrong. Stealing was wrong. You see this? Yes, ma'am. Oh, I'm sorry. My gods. I'm sorry. Which, by the way, that's correct. It's the end of the verse. It's his idols. If you follow the rest of that passage on, you'll see that he goes and then tries to find them in the tent. One of the daughters sits on him thing and hides them. Anyway, that's what happens in there. But notice the point is that he feels affronted. Why? Because he's been stolen from. He's been stolen from. Not okay to take stuff, is it? That's stealing. Ninth commandment. Don't bear false witness. Genesis 27. Hold on. Sorry. Let's not get far ahead. We have another passage there for the eighth commandment. Genesis 44, verses 1 through 14. Genesis 44, verses 1 through 14. And he commanded the steward of his house, saying, fill the men's sacks with food, as much as they can carry, and put every man's money in his sack's mouth. And put my cup, the silver cup, in the sack's mouth of the youngest, and his corn money. And he did according to the word that Joseph had spoken. As soon as the morning was light, the men were sent away, they and their asses. And when they were gone out of the city, and not yet far off, Joseph said unto his steward, up, follow after the men, and when thou dost overtake them, say unto them, wherefore have ye rewarded evil for good? Is it not that this in it in which my Lord drinketh, and whereby he divineth? Ye have done evil in so doing. And he overtook them, and he spake unto them these same words. Now, pause for a second. We're going to read with the rest of the passage, but understand what happened. Joseph has figured out a way that he wants to reveal himself to his brothers and his father. Okay? So they've come. He's given them food. They thanked him. Oh, man, we really appreciate that. And he actually kind of hinted to them, you know, you could stay. And they're like, oh, no, you know, we want to get out. We don't want to be stuck here, which was probably a smart thing because eventually, of course, that leads to slavery. But anyway, so they leave. He tells one of his servants, when you're filling up the food, stick my favorite cup in one of their bags, in the youngest. Who's that? Benjamin. Stick it in there. And then they leave, and he sends his men after them and says, find the cup and accuse them. Right? Now, that whole thing could not be true unless stealing was wrong. Are you with me? He set this thing up to make them get in trouble because they stole his cup, even though it was a setup. But you see what I'm putting this point here? They knew and he knew that stealing was wrong. Let's continue on. Let's start with verse 7. And they said unto him, wherefore saith my Lord these words? God forbid that thy servants should do according to this thing. Behold, the money which we found in our sack's mouth we brought again unto thee out of the land of Canaan. How then should we steal out of the Lord's house silver or gold? With whomsoever of thy servants it be found, both let him die, and we also will be my Lord's bondmen. So he's saying, hey, look, why would we do that? We would not do that. If you find it, whoever took it, let them be killed, and we'll all be your slaves. And he said now, verse 10, and he said now also let it be according unto your words. He with whom it is found shall be my servant, and ye shall be blameless. So he said, not so fast. I'll just say whoever we found it, they're going to be my slave. The rest of you won't have any problems. Then they speedily took down every man his sack to the ground and opened every man his sack. And he searched and began at the eldest and left at the youngest, and the cup was found in Benjamin's sack. Then they rent their clothes and laid at every man his ass, and returned to the city. And Judah and his brethren came to Joseph's house, for he was yet there, and they fell before him on the ground. So they're all, like, super upset now, because Benjamin, who they loved, their little brother, they found it in his sack. You don't even see them asking him about it, do you? Not in the passage. Do they say, what did you do? Nothing, not there. They're upset, they tear their clothes, they load back up and go back to the city. Why? They're going to plead. That's what they do. They do. All right. Ninth commandment. Do not bear false witness. Genesis 27, verses 6 through 13. Genesis 27:6-13. And Rebekah spake unto Jacob her son, saying, Behold, I heard thy father speak unto Esau thy brother, saying, Bring me venison, and make me savory meat, that I may eat, and bless thee before the Lord before my death. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to that which I commanded thee. Go now to the flock, and fetch me from thence 2 good kids of the goats, and I will make them savory meat for thy father, such as he loveth. And thou shalt bring it to thy father, that he may eat, and that he may bless thee before his death. And Jacob said to Rebekah his mother, Behold, Esau my brother is a hairy man, and I am a smooth man. My father peradventure will feel me, and I shall seem to him as a deceiver, and I will bring a curse upon me, and not a blessing. And his mother said unto him, Upon me be thy curse, my son, only obey my voice and go fetch me them. Now, we're not going to spend any time breaking down what happened exactly with Jacob and Esau here, but understand that Jacob recognizes, if I trick my father, he's going to curse me. And she recognizes it too and says, let the curse be on me. Why? It's lying. It's deception. It's wrong. They knew it prior to the Ten Commandments. Tenth, don't covet. Genesis 6, verses 1 and 2. And it came to pass, when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. So why did they take the wives? Because they coveted them. Who were the sons of God? We're not going to talk about that right now. We're moving on. Genesis 13, verses 6 through 18. Genesis 13, verses 6 through 18. And the land was not able to bear them, that they might dwell together, for their substance was great, so that they could not dwell together. And there was a strife between the herdmen of Abram's cattle and the herdmen of Lot's cattle, and the Canaanite and the Perizzite dwelled in the land. And Abram said unto Lot, Let there be no strife, I pray thee, between me and thee, and between my herdmen and thy herdmen, for we are brethren. For we be brethren. Is not the whole land before thee? Separate thyself, I pray thee, from me. If thou wilt take the left hand, then I will go to the right. Or if thou depart to the right hand, then I will go to the left. And Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plains of Jordan, that it was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah, even as the garden of the Lord, like the land of Egypt, as thou comest unto Zoar. Then Lot chose him all the plain of Jordan, and Lot journeyed east, and they separated themselves the one from the other. Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain, and pitched his tent towards Sodom. But the men of Sodom were wicked and sinners before the Lord exceedingly. And the Lord said unto Abram, After that Lot was separated from him, lift up now thy eyes, and look from the place where thou art northward, and southward, and eastward, and westward. For all the land which thou seest, to thee will I give it, and to thy seed forever. And I will make thy seed as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall thy seed also be numbered. Arise, walk through the land in the length of it and in the breadth of it, for I will give it unto thee. Then Abraham removed his tent and came and dwelt in the plain of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and built there an altar unto the Lord. So what happened with Lot? Lot saw the land and wanted the land. There was not any description here of Lot using any other faculty to determine where he should go other than, oh, that looks good. I want that. That looks good. I want that. Now, what ends up happening? Not good things. Bad things. He picked the wrong place. But that's what he wanted. That's what he sought. Let's move on. The circumstances of its reiteration. So it's reiterated here in the Ten Commandments. That's what we're calling this. We're saying that it was a repetition of the moral law. It was reiterated here. Here's the circumstances. God clarified and restated his law in Ten Commandments on Mount Sinai, written in stone for all mankind. Two tablets expressing the two greatest commandments, our duty to God and our duty to our fellow man. That's what we see in the Ten Commandments. This is in Deuteronomy 10:4, which says, And he wrote on the tables, according to the first writing, the Ten Commandments, which the Lord spake unto you in the mount in the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly, and the Lord gave them unto me. Now, we're going to talk about that. There is a, not today, we're not going to have enough time, but there is a, the Scripture talks about a terrible or a terror from Mount Sinai, where God actually speaks the Ten Commandments to the people of Israel. They are so afraid that they tell Moses, go into the mountain and talk to God. We don't want to hear that anymore. It's too scary to them. The whole mountain shook. A cloud descended. God literally spoke the words of the Ten Commandments to them. Moses then goes up. God writes them on tablets of stone. He brings those back down. No longer does Israel want to hear directly from God. They want to hear through Moses, and they ask for that. And God says, okay, I'll do that. That's an awesome event that happened. We rarely think about that. That is what accompanied God giving his law. Did God do that when he said, don't eat shellfish? No. How about when he said, you must sacrifice for your sins at the temple? Did that come from God's voice? Did he put that in stone? Did he write it with his very finger? None of those. Is there a difference? Obviously, there is a difference. We'll get into it more. Paragraph 3. Besides this law, commonly called moral, God, now you see right away, right? So the paragraph 3, the confession is making a distinction between the types of law. We do not recognize all law as law. We recognize them as distinct kinds of law. Besides this law, commonly called moral, God was pleased to give to the people of Israel ceremonial laws containing several typical ordinances, partly of worship, prefiguring Christ, his graces, actions, sufferings, and benefits, and partly holding forth diverse instructions of moral duties, all which ceremonial laws being appointed only to the time of Reformation. That's not the 1500-1600 Reformation, by the way, that's Jesus Christ, are by Jesus Christ the true Messiah and only lawgiver, who was furnished with the power from the Father for that end, abrogated and taken away. Now, this does say it all, but it's a little bit hard to understand in some way. So that's why we break it down. Or else I don't have a job. We just have to read through the thing and we're done. All right. What's the purpose of the ceremonial law? So the law given to all mankind through Adam and reiterated in the Ten Commandments is recognized here as the moral law. So everything we've been talking about, the first two paragraphs, commonly called, besides this law, commonly called moral. So in other words, the first two paragraphs is talking about the moral law. In addition to his moral law, God gave ceremonial laws to the people of Israel explicitly. So did the ceremonial laws, was that given to any other people? It was not. It was only given to his people. Over and over again, references to my people, and ye shall. And there's references to them, not to all mankind. These laws include several typical ordinances, which are partly of worship. This is what it's talking about here. Partly of worship, but are also prefiguring Christ's graces, actions, sufferings, and benefits. We call these types of Christ or foreshadows of Christ. So these ceremonial things were things that gave us a foreshadowing of Christ. So what's the sacrifice? A foreshadow of Christ dying on the cross as our sacrifice. Does that make sense? These laws also partly holding forth diverse instructions of moral duties, meaning they also partly reflect specific moral laws, which must be kept in alignment with God's law, moral law. So let's look at Hebrews. I'll just read it to you. Hebrews 10:1. For the law, having a shadow of good things to come, and not the very image of the things, can never, with those sacrifices which they offered year by year, continually make the comers there unto perfect. In other words, in Hebrews, the passage is saying that, look, even though those sacrifices that were in the ceremonial law were reflecting what was going to come, those sacrifices can't make the people making them perfect. Why? It wasn't enough. They were animals, not a perfect God. And that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, was the only one that could actually make you holy or for you redeemed. Does that make sense? Colossians 2:17, which are a shadow of things to come, but the body is of Christ. Again, it's another reference. Multiple references in Romans to this, but the whole idea being the ceremonial law were things that were to reflect what was to come. We have to stop there. We're out of time. So we'll pick back up with the abrogation of the ceremonial law next week. Let's pray.